afternoon. My topic this afternoon is Spanish Flu, the Great Pandemic Influenza of 1918, Lessons from History. I had originally intended to speak on a different topic this afternoon, but I was asked by the CME committee to speak about influenza. As I considered this request, I realized there were a lot of avenues I could take on this most interesting topic, but I've chosen to speak about history, because it is the events of 1918, or those that could be similar, that give those people responsible for public health their sleepless nights. I'd like to introduce this history by a discussion of what life was like in 1918. When I was a child, 1918 seemed hopelessly ancient, but it doesn't seem that way to me anymore. It's less than two of my lifetimes. Life was different, though, in 1918. The population in the United States was less than one-third of what it is now, and life expectancies were about two-thirds of what they are now. Many of you listening to this talk would, in fact, be living on borrowed time were this 1918. One in five children did not live beyond their fifth birthday at that time. What was going on in the second decade of the 20th century? Well, in 1913, the first home refrigerator was sold in Chicago. In 1914, the first traffic light went up in Cleveland. And in 1915, the first transcontinental telephone call occurred between Alexander Graham Bell and Thomas Watson. Of course, the most dramatic thing occurring at the end of the second decade of the 20th century was that we were going to war. Thousands of young men were leaving for army camps as the country mobilized. The country was rapidly industrializing. If it was not the world's preeminent industrial power, it soon would be. Associated with industrialization were a number of issues, including labor strife and life on the mass production assembly line. How did we get around? Well, if we were traveling between cities, it was by railroad. Automobiles were comparatively rare, although that was changing quickly. Road networks, though, were quite limited. How did we communicate? Long-distance communication was via telegraph. Telephones were expensive and were not always available. There was instantaneous communication across the Atlantic Ocean via transatlantic cable. Radio had been invented, but was not yet commercially available. Increasingly, we had leisure time and money to enjoy our leisure time. People congregated in a variety of settings to entertain themselves. The movies were immensely popular. Films were still silent films. The talkies had yet to arrive. Women began more and more to assume roles outside the home. In particular, the war brought opportunities for this to occur. In 1916, Montana elected the first woman member of Congress. The country, as now, was a country of immigrants. This was no more so true than at the turn of the 19th century and the first decades of the 20th century. As now, and as at other times of increased immigration, there was anti-immigration sentiment in some quarters. As I mentioned, though, the war was one of the overriding events going on. The United States had entered the war in 1917. There was a draft. There were large, hastily erected encampments of draftees and enlistees. There were anti-sedition measures in place. Some of these would make former Vice President Cheney very envious. What about medicine? In the 19th century, it was provided by a whole variety of providers, including doctors, druggists, midwives, and so forth. By 1918, some of these medicine was becoming a little bit more scientific. Some doctors had offices, and hospitals were increasingly used for provision of medical care. Nonetheless, many Americans might spend their entire lives without visiting a doctor. What about doctors specifically? Well, as I mentioned, or had suggested, perhaps, anybody could call himself a physician in the 18th and 19th centuries, but by 1900, every state had some type of registration law, and half the states required physicians to possess a diploma. Grandfather laws nonetheless assured that many poorly trained practitioners remained in practice. Scientific medicine was beginning to assert itself. A growing number of scientists and physicians came to realize that diseases were spread by microorganisms, and this transformed the practice of medicine. Despite this, only a rudimentary understanding existed of the different types of microorganisms. Public health was becoming an increasingly important discipline. It began with sanitarians traveling about cities trying to clean up those cities in terms of garbage and sewage disposal. It was realized that such measures reduced the likelihood of epidemic disease. Public health campaigns became increasingly sophisticated as they urged persons to avoid germs, the cause of agents of disease. Public health had reached the point that by 1918, Americans looked to public health and government to inform them about how to battle disease. The Public Health Service, which had been founded in 1798 to protect mariners, had become increasingly an agency charged with trying to protect the health of Americans. At the time of the epidemic of 1918, there were less than 700 public health officers, however. These tended to be the more highly trained physicians. Finally, what was known about influenza prior to 1918? Obviously, we did not have the means of diagnosing this illness, nor was it known what was its cause. However, it certainly had been noted over time that there were seasonal outbreaks of disease. Hippocrates described the respiratory illness in 412 BC that likely was influenza. Italians gave it its name with a word meaning influence of the cold and stars. This reflected the fact that it occurred in the wintertime. In the 19th century, leading up to the epidemic of 1918, cycles of illness that likely were pandemics had occurred in 1857, 1874, and 1890. So now we reach influenza, the outbreak. We have set the stage. Influenza in 1918 occurred in three waves. The first wave developed in the spring of 1918. No one really knows where it originated, but scientists, historians, and epidemiologists who have studied the outbreak, the pandemic of 1918, believe it occurred in Kansas. There were several cases of influenza-like illness in Haskell County, Kansas, and shortly thereafter, there was a large outbreak of influenza at an army camp at Fort Riley, Kansas. It was actually called Camp Funston, which was one of the camps on that base. Within a month of the first case, there were over 1,000 cases of influenza and 48 deaths. Patients were described as, quote, drowning in their bloody, fluid-filled lungs. Camp doctors thought they found evidence of Bacillus influenza, which was at the time thought perhaps to be the cause of influenza. Obviously, this was erroneous, as we now know. This is the bacterium that we now know as Haemophilus influenza. Although this infection behaved very aggressively at Camp Funston, in general, as it spread across the country in the first wave in the spring of 1918, it behaved like typical seasonal influenza with relatively mild illness. By April, it had spread to most cities in the United States. And as I said, it was scarcely noted, or as I suggest, it was scarcely noted because this was not an unusual occurrence. Influenza disappeared from the United States in the summer of 1918, but Europe was a different story. All over Europe, civilians and soldiers were made ill. The general that commanded the German armies at the Battle of the Marne, General von Ludendorff, complained that influenza actually interfered with the success of his armies at that battle. Whether this is true is, of course, unknown. This could have just been a convenient excuse, but it is certainly clear that combatants on both sides were made very ill by this this virus. Not only were combatants made ill, but the civilian populace was as well. Trains stopped running, governments and businesses closed. Europeans called it the Spanish flu. It's not because it arose in Spain. It is likely because the Spaniards were non-combatants and did not employ the censorship about bad things that the other warring countries did. Therefore, there was a lot more discussion of this infection in Spain. The second wave began in the fall of 1918, and it virtually exploded in three different places. And this was the wave of intense virulence. The places where it arose were Boston, Massachusetts, Brest, France, and Freetown, Sierra Leone. Brest, France is where soldiers were embarking for the battlefields of Europe. And Freetown is a coaling station on the coast of Africa where ships would stop to take on fuel and water. I will be talking principally, of course, about the United States. In Boston, as I mentioned, that's where the influenza hit and the dying began. Three sailors were ill on August 27th, 8 cases the next day, 58 cases the day after that, 81 cases the day after that, and so forth. Soon there were 2,000 sailors of the 1st Naval District desperately sick. Simultaneously at Camp Devens, 35 miles northwest of Boston, there was a large outbreak of influenza. A camp hospital designed to hold 2,000 soldiers soon had 8,000, and ultimately there were about 13,000 cases of influenza on this camp. And it behaved very, very aggressively. 500 soldiers ultimately died at this one location. Here's a quote from Dr. Victor Vaughn, acting Surgeon General of the Army. Quote, I saw hundreds of young, stalwart men in uniform coming into the wards of the hospital. Every bed was full, yet others crowded in. The faces wore a bluish cast. A cough brought up the blood-stained sputum. In the morning, the dead bodies are stacked about the morgue-like cordwood. Here it was, influenza 1918 in all of its intense virulence. In some ways, a pandemic could not have chosen a more favorable time to occur because the country was in the midst of preparation for war. This is a quote from Alfred Crosby, author of Epidemic and Peace, which described the pandemic event of 1918, and he goes in this quote, he talks about how on September 11th, officials in Washington disclosed to reporters about their fear of Spanish influenza and its portents. The next day, all across the country, young men lined up for the draft, 13 million of them, and they were coughing and sneezing on one another, and of course, this gave every opportunity for this virus to propagate. These slides then show the progress of the second wave of influenza across the United States. And as you can see from these graphs, from September 14th through early October, this virus very quickly spread all the way across the country, leaving no corner untouched. We in this day and age, worry about the rapid spread of infections such as influenza B because of air travel and the very interconnectedness of the world. But what you can see from this example from 1918, that influenza doesn't need an airplane to rapidly propagate. So pandemic influenza had arrived in full force. Here are some pictures illustrating how people reacted. Here are police officers in Seattle and trolley drivers in Seattle wearing their masks. And here's a notice from the Chicago Commissioner of Health about how to behave in terms of influenza. Here are statistics, and they're very dramatic. 500,000 cases in New York, 350,000 in Pennsylvania, 220,000 in Virginia, and so forth. October 17th was called Black Thursday in Chicago because 381 people died that day and 1,200 people became sick. This is just one example. There were any number of cities across the United States that had equally black days with as many or more deaths. What was the illness? Well, the symptoms and signs included 102 to 104 degree temperature, sore throat, exhaustion, prostration, headache, aching limbs, in other words, influenza. Many patients recovered only to suffer a relapse, and the relapse were typically of respiratory illness, then presumably bacterial superinfection, which of course we know complicates influenza. But what is very striking about how this virus caused illness was the rapid deaths that occurred in many otherwise healthy people. There are lots of contemporaneous accounts of people apparently well one day being dead the following day. This is a victim of influenza's lungs as artistically rendered. This was Private Cavell, who died in France on October 8th, 1918. And it's very frightening and sobering to read the description of the pathology as described, quote, the lungs on cut section drip bloody and frothy serum, and there is absence of pus in the bronchi and very little fibrin formation. There is an intense hemorrhagic bronchitis, etc., etc. Well, chaos ensued, and of course this is a lesson for us as to what can happen in the face of epidemic disease. Schools and factories closed, churches, libraries, private clubs locked their doors, government services failed, garbage was uncollected, it became difficult to find food and coal. In essence, the fabric of what was then modern life was in jeopardy of entirely unraveling. People were desperate, and this is a quote that I'd like to read to you from a survivor. Quote, my parents went for help. They stood for hours outside Pennsylvania Hospital but were turned away. So they came home and made their own remedies like castor oil, laxatives. My grandfather made wine. Nothing helped. Everyone in my family, my parents, grandparents, my aunts, and my brother Daniel, everyone up and down our block was sick. There were no medicines, no doctors, nothing people could do to heal themselves. My grandfather was very religious. He was an Orthodox Jew, and he wore his talith shawl, and he prayed, hoping that God would take away the illness. Everyone in our house grew weaker and weaker. Then my brother Daniel died. My aunt saw the horse-drawn wagon coming down the street. The strongest person in our family carried Daniel's body to the sidewalk. Everyone was too weak to protest. There were no coffins in the wagon, just bodies piled on top of each other. Daniel was two. He was just a little boy. They put him in the wagon and took him away. Another quote illustrating the desperation of the time. Normally, stealing a casket would be inconceivable. It would be equated with grave robbing. But in October 1918, the influenza pandemic changed people's minds about what they would do, how they would act. People were desperate. They felt like they had no alternative. There was no place for them to turn. These were nice people, people who wouldn't have done this otherwise. some of them, stealing a casket was the only way they could see to provide for their loved one. And then there was Frank Horror. In this picture, you can see the Leviathan. This was a German passenger liner that had been confiscated at the beginning of World War I and now was being used as a troop ship. It could carry 12,000 soldiers at a time in very, very cramped quarters. So it sailed from New York in September of 1918. En route to Brest, over 2,000 soldiers fell ill with influenza. Efforts at trying to quarantine these soldiers have failed because of the very cramped, closed quarters and the overwhelming number of soldiers. Not only did the soldiers become ill, but the ship's complement of medical personnel were victims as well. Over 200 soldiers died in this transatlantic passage, and of course were buried at sea. What about medicine at this time? Well, to begin with, 40,000 of the United States' physicians were in Europe with the armies, and these likely were the better physicians. Nurses were even in shorter supply. There existed at that time a rivalry, I guess would be the best way to describe it, between the medical profession and the nursing profession, and for some reason the nurses chose, that is, the nurses in authority, chose not to expand the ranks of surgeons, which it seems unimaginable, but that is what occurred. It was not known, of course, what caused this illness, and many therapies were tried, but none were effective. Not only were medical therapies tried, but remedies, as you might read about in the newspaper, and measures to try to avoid becoming infected were tried. None of them, likewise, were effective. Public health measures were generally ineffective, and this in part related to the fact that the war imperatives seemed to trump the public health imperatives despite the severity of the outbreak. For example, General Gorgias' plea to discontinue transit of soldiers from one cantonment to another was ignored. There was, at least in one place where public health measures did work, that is in Australia, where the quarantine of ships coming into Australia allowed that country to avoid the second wave of the epidemic. Apparently the third wave did arrive there, but the second was avoided. Well, there was a reprieve. The second wave ended, for the most part, at about the time of the World War I armistice. The decline was not uniform, but the grim statistics of September and October of 1918 were never repeated. The third wave, however, began in the spring of 1919. In general, it didn't behave as aggressively as had the second wave, but in some places it did so. For example, in Paris, France, this wave was particularly hard. 2,676 Parisians died during the week of February 22nd. President Woodrow Wilson was in France at that time, attending the Versailles peace talks. He became very ill. Some people have speculated that his illness sapped his vitality such that he didn't press his case for his version of the World War I settlement. And as we know, the British and French pressed for a punitive settlement against the Central Powers, and some of this punitiveness probably led to the resentments, or did lead to the resentments that ultimately resulted in the Second World War. Epilogue. Well, here are the statistics. One out of three persons alive in 1918 became symptomatically ill, and the death rate was about 2 to 2.5%. This translated to 20 million to 50 million deaths worldwide. In the United States, there were 500,000 to 675,000 deaths, and what is very sobering is that the average age of death in the United States was 33. Most of the deaths occurred in the ages of 20 to 40. This is not like how seasonal influenza typically behaves, where it causes death in the extremes of life, infants and the elderly. 621,000 U.S. servicemen became ill and 43,000 died. Two-thirds of the deaths occurred in a 24-week period. I think I read that 190,000 U.S. citizens died in October of 1918. And of course, it's impossible to imagine the social misery and dislocation implicit in these dry statistics. Here's a picture of the epidemic curve, created obviously many years ago, and I like these historical images. Another depiction of this epidemic curve was more recently published in the New York Times, and this is the epidemic as it occurred in England, and you can see very clearly the three waves of influenza deaths that occurred, and also you can see that in England the first wave was in the summer of 1918 rather than the spring of 1918. This is a rather famous curve depicting infectious disease mortality in the United States in the 20th century, and you can see the very dramatic spike in deaths in the 1918-19 period due to the pandemic Spanish flu. There was a tendency to forget the pandemic of 1918-1919 in the years that followed, it wasn't until recent years that there was an emphasis once again on what did occur. And this emphasis has obviously arisen because of the bird flu and also because of the possibilities of bioterrorism. But why the amnesia? There are a number of speculations. One is that World War I and its dramatic events seem to obscure what happened in influenza. Also, influenza hit communities quickly and then disappeared, and despite its horrors, it was not long-lasting, and perhaps people had no time to fully comprehend what was going on. And I also theorize that death was much less a stranger to us back in 1918 than it would appear to be now. So those are all the possibilities. What about pandemic flu today? Well, obviously, it's a much different time. We have very good global and national surveillance. There is better health care, medicines, and diagnostics, and there is greater vaccine manufacturing capacity. Here are a couple images of a table and a graph that illustrate this ability to survey for influenza. And you can see in the right-hand graph the surveillance that illustrates the advent of this recent swine flu epidemic. It's amazing, but the influenza 1918 virus has been resurrected from paraffin samples of tissue of victims and also from victims exhumed from the permafrost where they were buried after becoming, after dying from influenza. And researchers have been able to identify portions of the 1918 influenza virus segments of the genome that appear to have given it its enhanced virulence. Despite all these advances, there are actually increased risks of epidemic influenza today as well. One is the fact that population density is so much higher. And you can see in the picture in the lower left, Sao Paulo, Brazil, the world's largest city, and look at the density of the population here, and just imagine the wildfire with which an influenza virus could travel through such settings. We have more elderly and immunosuppressed who are at risk of complications of influenza, more daycare and nursing homes. There is the prospect of bioterrorism, where this organism could be engineered potentially to cause epidemic disease. And then, of course, there is increased global travel and commerce. And as I mentioned, I don't think you need airplanes for this virus to spread, but the global commerce is the point that I'd like to make here. We are now so interdependent for our goods and services that a wholesale epidemic of influenza could wreak havoc on the availability of food and services and life in general. I should say that also, despite our ability to vaccinate and treat with antivirals, some strains of influenza are resistant to Tamiflu, and were we to be faced with a resistant strain to our available antivirals, that would obviously be very serious. And there is certainly there would certainly be a race between the ability to produce vaccine and the advent of a virus. And could we really expect to have enough vaccine to vaccinate enough of the world's population to prevent wholesale death? Here's a projection for the United States for the next pandemic, and this does not suppose a strain of influenza with the virulence of 1918, but a more conventional strain. And you can see there were projected to be between 89,000 and 207,000 deaths, and a proportionate number of hospitalizations. I like this quote from Howard Markle, who is a historian of medicine and a physician, and he's at the University of Michigan, and it reads, quote, "One thing the history of epidemics teaches us is that given our remarkable arsenal of treatments, public health measures, and rapid surveillance and communications ability, there's never been a better time to have a pandemic than today, except that is tomorrow." And certainly I would vote for postponing a pandemic till tomorrow as we become ever more skilled in our abilities to deal with them. And I would say this is a sort of an optimistic look at the prospects of pandemic infectious disease. I would like to begin to conclude my talk with some other quotes from survivors of the epidemic. Again, this is just to give us all a flavor of just what the circumstances were like and what they might be like in the event of another severe outbreak of pandemic flu. "At the time, people were dying like flies. It really was a terrible, terrible time. Stood in the middle of the city at 2 p.m. on a weekday, there was not a soul to be seen. No trams running, no shops open. It was really a city of the dead. People believed that the world was going to end. Somebody could come home from school that night, and they were dead the next morning. He is the only doctor there, and kept going long after he should have been in bed. He died the next day. Death could come from anyone, anytime. People moved away from others on the sidewalk, avoided conversation." Finally, this is the enlistment record of my grandfather, Private William A. Muth. And I came across this not too long ago. My grandfather passed away in the 1970s. And you can read on this form that he was in the American Expeditionary Force. His physical condition was good. He received immunization for typhoid and paratyphoid. He had excellent character, and he served in France and Germany. But what I was particularly interested in was to read that he left the United States on September 1st, 1918. So he was on one of those troop ships crossing the Atlantic. I never thought to ask him about the events of that time, and in particular about what he recalled about influenza. But he was fortunate. Here he is with my grandmother and my father, a picture taken some years later. He survived not only the Spanish flu, but also the Kaiser, and for that I'm very grateful. And with that, I will conclude my talk. Thank you very much. Thank you.